I introduced Laurie and myself. I want to ask you about someone you might have known a long time ago. Does the name Dunstan mean anything to you? He crossed his arms over his chest. How did you learn I was out here? From someone who doesn't want to be named, I said. He wrote your name on a piece of paper. Water's getting deeper and deeper, Edison said. I used to know a man who married a woman named Dunstan. Will you stop beating around the bush, Laurie said. I only have about an hour before I have to drive back to town. He obviously knows it was Toby Kraft. Edison and I both looked at her, then at each other. We burst out laughing. Man didn't want to be named, Edison said. I spoiled your fun, but I bet Mr. Edison could already tell us who we came here to talk about. Why don't you tell me so I won't have to guess? Edward Reinhardt, I said. Edison looked at the door. We should grab some fresh air. It's so pretty under those trees. You can almost forget where you are. Max Edison faced the tall beeches and the long green lawn from the end of the bench across our picnic table. Toby Kraft. I called him Mr. Inside because that's what he was. Toby Kraft asked me to help out in the pawn shop 3 days a week. Every town the size of Edgerton has a Mr. Inside. He can tell you where to go if you want something. About a year after I started part-timing, Toby set up another situation for me. For the next 7 years, all hours of the day and night, I drove Mr. Edward Reinhardt wherever he wanted to go. So what did he do? I asked. Where you find a Mr. Inside, eventually you will learn there is also a Mr. Outside. Mr. Outside is more important than Mr. Inside. If you happen to be a professional criminal, one night you are invited to a hotel room. Way back in the room where you can't see his face, Mr. Outside is sitting in a big, comfortable chair, and he explains from now on you won't do anything unless he tells you so. 1/3 of all your profits go straight to him. You want to walk out, but he starts to explain the benefits. He's covering all the expenses. You never go to the trouble of breaking into a place and discover it was already stripped clean. Edward Reinhardt was Mr. Outside? Laurie asked. Edison pulled down his sunglasses and leaned forward. Did you hear me say that? He pushed the sunglasses up over his eyes. Mr. Reinhardt doesn't sound like the sort of man who would write a book, I said. What book? Laurie asked. It was in the box my mother sent to herself, the one with the envelope and the key. Did you read that book? Edison asked. Not yet. Did you? Mr. Reinhardt gave me a copy, but I got lost along the way. Around the time he came out with his book, he retired.
Did you see him after he retired?
He wasn't the kind of man to keep in touch. Anyhow, I got sent up to do a little stretch in Greenhaven.
Edison took off his sunglasses and folded them on the table.
Then what happened? One of Reinhardt's men got busted for some dumbass thing. And as soon as that man started looking at jail time, he rolled over on Mr. Reinhardt, and he got arrested.
Edward Reinhardt went to jail? Laurie asked.
On a minimum 10-year sentence, yes, ma'am. I was present when he came in. Mr. Reinhardt acted like he was on a first-class trip to Paris. At Greenhaven, he was free to do just about everything he wanted. I was released in November 1958. A little over 2 years later, they had a big riot up there. When the troopers moved in, 12 men were lying dead in the yard, and one of them was Mr. Reinhardt. He's up there in the Greenhaven Cemetery. That's not a bad place for him.
What? Laurie said. Oh, you were afraid of him.
Edison gave us a slow smile. Sometimes I think I'm still afraid of him. One time, 3-4 o'clock in the morning, I took him to Mountry to meet a man named Ted Bryant in a building back of a garage. We pulled up, and Reinhardt said, "Step down and keep down until I get back." I looked over my shoulder, and I guess either I went blind or the seat could talk, because Mr. Reinhardt wasn't there. Footsteps came around from in front, 2 guys moving slow and careful.
One of them said, "That's his car." The other said, "Let's do the deed." All of a sudden, there was enough noise out there to wake up a graveyard. Right in front of me, Ted Bright slams against the hood, covered neck to belly in blood. Bright rolls off and hits the ground. I look at the front of the building. A body is lying face down in the dirt, holding the door open. There's another body halfway in, halfway out. Place looks like a slaughterhouse. Right behind me, someone clears his throat, and I almost jump out of my clothes. Mr. Reinhardt's sitting in the back seat. "Let's get back to civilization," he says. What I'm telling you is, Mr. Edward Reinhardt could be a one-man Halloween.
As Lori and I drove back, through the windshield I could see the low, sensible skyline of the city where I had been born. Such places were not supposed to contain people like Edward Reinhardt. I turned to Lori. "You and Cavi shouldn't have anything to do with this Reinhardt stuff. I'd rather be Donald Mesmer's son. Cavi and I can't be in danger from a dead man. And tonight we are going to find this Donald Mesmer. Posey will be back just after 5 o'clock. Posey and I will give you dinner, and you can show me Edward Reinhardt's book. I'm picking you up at 6. From my room, I called Suki Teeter. Then I took the bus to her house. In her living room, Suki sat next to me on the yielding cushions. I described my mother's last day and night. At the mention of Reinhardt's name, Suki gave me a glance of uncomplicated acknowledgement. Without saying anything more, I told her about Donald Mesmer's appearance on the marriage license and my birth certificate. "I have got to get out of the fog. I want to know who Reinhardt was and how this Mesmer came into the picture. Please, just tell me." Suki Teeter leaned back into her cushions. In the autumn of 1957, the more adventurous students of arts and literature at Albertus noted the frequent late-night presence at a rear table in the Blue Onion Coffee House of a man bent in concentration over what appeared to be a typewritten manuscript. This was Edward Reinhardt. Slowly, Reinhardt's barriers relaxed. Yes, he was a writer. He had come to College Park to enjoy good bookstores and congenial companionship. He became the intellectual and social focus of a select cadre of students. At the end of Buxton Place, an obscure cul-de-sac, Reinhardt had purchased 2 adjacent cottages as studio and living quarters. In Reinhardt's house, someone was always talking, generally Reinhardt. Reinhardt provided the drugs of the period. His parties went on for 2 or 3 days, in which the favorites wandered in and out and had frequent sex, mostly with the host. Suki, Starr, and the other young women had fallen under Reinhardt's spell. Now and then, Reinhardt's devotees would come upon him in conference with men clearly unconnected to Albertus. One of these men was Donald Mesmer, who lived in the Hotel Paris on Word Street, and did whatever came to hand. "Donald Mesmer wasn't a criminal," Suki said. "Basically, Don was this very easygoing guy who just sort of hung out. The guy probably never read a book in his life, and all of a sudden he's walking around with novels sticking out of his back pocket because he wants to impress Star Dunstan. But he didn't have a chance. She was in love with Edward Reinhardt, along with the rest of us." "How did Mesmer's name wind up on her marriage license?" "Hold on," Suki said. "Let me tell you what I know." At the end of the semester, Suki transferred to Wheeler College in Wheeler, Ohio. She had lost faith in Edward Reinhardt and wanted to escape his sphere of influence. Late in the winter of the following year, Star Dunstan appeared in Wheeler, pregnant, exhausted, and in need of a safe place to stay. Star told her that she had married a man, but that the marriage had been a mistake. She told Suki that her husband had abandoned her when a doctor told her that she might be carrying twins. Eventually, she packed her things and left for Cherry Street. At the end of the school term, Suki drove to Edgerton and moved in hours before the descent of a powerful storm. She called Aunt Nettie, without response. Perhaps the Cherry Street telephone lines were out. She called Toby Kraft and got through. Toby told her that Star had been admitted to St. Anne's Community Hospital and was about to give birth. He was beside himself with worry. The river had overflowed its banks and cables had blown down everywhere. Suki belted herself into a rain slicker and went outside. Floodwater sluicing around the low wall of sandbags rose over her ankles. Suki climbed over the barricade and waded toward the hospital's entrance. The lobby looked like Calcutta. Suki ran up to the cacophony of the obstetrics department. A nurse said that her friend was in delivery room B, attended by midwife Hazel Jansky. Suki retreated into the waiting room. Sometime later, a younger nurse ducked in to tell her that Mrs. Dunstan was making progress. Suki lowered herself onto the sofa and fell asleep. A muffled explosion followed by women's screams woke her up. The lights failed. Suki took off in search of Star. When she came to the door of the second delivery room, the door knocked her backward as it burst open. A figure put a hand on her shoulder and pushed her to the side. Suki stumbled in. Whoever was in the room whimpered. Suki touched a wet, bare leg. Star gasped and pulled her into an embrace.
Suki, they took my babies away.
As abruptly as it had failed, the electricity jumped back into life. The midwife bustled in and placed in Star's hands a doll-like infant, tightly wrapped in a blue blanket. Star protested. She had delivered two children. The midwife told her that what she had mistaken for a second child was the placenta. Hours later, a harried doctor came in to reassure Star that she had delivered a single, healthy child. Thereafter, Star maintained a resolute silence about her pregnancy and marriage. Suki patted my cheek and said that maybe we could have lunch together after my mother's funeral. Back in my room in the boarding house, I took From Beyond out of my knapsack and flopped on the bed to read until Laurie Hatch showed up. I started at the beginning. In Professor Pendant's Inheritance, a retired professor of Middle Eastern Studies moves to an 18th century fishing village where a former colleague had unexpectedly bequeathed him an old house and a vast, legendary library. Soon after, he discovers a 12th century manuscript of dire incantations. At the story's end, Professor Pendant is devoured by the ancient god, one-third octopus, one-third snake, and one-third indescribable but hideous all the same, summoned by the manuscript. Recent events in rural Massachusetts describe the visit to a bleak hamlet of a young scholar who falls prey to a race of stunted beings produced by sexual congress between primitive hominids and a ravenous deity from beyond the membrane of our universe. Blue Fire was a novella about the life of one Godfrey Denneman, whose experiences sometimes resembled nightmare versions of my own. And for all my fascination, I had to struggle against the impulse to set the book on fire and toss it into the sink. The child Demoman receives a summons from an ancient wood at the edge of town. After he enters the woods, an inhuman voice informs him that he is the son of an elder god, a new Jesus who shall bring about the apocalypse by giving entry to his unearthly fathers. Through the agency of a sacred blue fire, he is granted unnatural powers. He displays these powers to local girls and kills them. Exiled to a military school, he drifts into madness under the influence of a sacred text. In his early 30s, Demoman moves to the city beloved of the text's author and is drawn to a forbidding manse. He imagines himself stalked by furtive beings connected to both himself and the house, breaks in and discovers the crypt of 18th century Demoman's. It is his ancestral home. Two nights later, the darkening of the atmosphere suggests that the other will at last permit himself to be seen. At the sound of a car pulling up in front of the roomy house, I looked up and saw Laurie's car backing into a parking space. I jammed the book in my pocket, opened my door, and extended a foot through the frame. I could go no further. Like an X-ray, a sharp pain pierced my head from back to front. Instead of Helen Jeanette's hallway, before me lay the room I had seen as a child and in the midst of my breakdown at Middlemount. A dying fern, a stuffed fox under a glass bell, and a brass clock occupied a mantelpiece. Somewhere out of sight, a man muttered an indistinct stream of words. All of this had existed long before my own time on Earth. I lurched backward, and the scene dissolved. I ran downstairs toward Laurie Hatch. As we neared the expressway, Laurie, who had listened with only half an ear as I described Reinhardt's book, and my conversation with Suki Teeter came to life. You solved everything in one day. We have to celebrate. I asked if Kavi had come home all right. Yes. Stuart brought him home and then favored us with his company for several hours. He helped himself to gallons of scotch and repeated the same things over and over. Most of them were about you. Me? Vincent, the head waiter at Le Madrigal, had informed Grenville Milton that I had joined Mrs. Hatch and Mrs. Ashton. Milton had reported to Stuart, who already knew because his private detective had told him. Her eyes flashed at me. Stuart is especially batty when it comes to you. Going places with a Dunstan is like associating with Charles Manson. After destroying the Hanging Gardens of Babylon and introducing the Black Death to Europe, your family got really awful. They settled in Edgerton, where they practiced voodoo and cheated at cards. We always were a little peculiar, I said. The tiles on the roof of the big house on Blueberry Lane were made of rubberized plastic. Who built this house? I asked Lori. She grimaced. It's one of Granny Milton's masterpieces. To feel at home in it, you have to wear a pink blazer and green pants. We went into a vast space in which islands of furniture seemed to float a few inches off a pale carpet. Kavi hurtled round a corner. A dark-haired young woman in blue jeans and a loose cotton sweater appeared in his wake. Ned, Posey Fairbrother, my savior. Posey gave me a crisp handshake. Kavi's been talking about you all afternoon.
Ned, we're having knocked out cuckoo spaghetti.
You and I are having spaghetti, Posey told Kavi. You can say goodnight to Ned afterward, and then he's going to have dinner with your mommy. Lori moved around them, holding a wine glass in each hand. Kavi, you and Posey go in the kitchen. I'll be there in a minute. Kavi put his hand into Posey's and vanished around the corner. Lori held out a slip of paper. Posey found a listing for a Donald Messmer in Mountree. Well, I spend a little time with Kavi. Would you like to see what he has to say? Posey's CD-ROM had located the phone number of the right Donald Messmer, but it took me a couple of minutes to get him talking.
You saw my name on the marriage license, and you got curious about me, huh? I was a stupid kid. The idea of having a child was almost more than I could handle. When she came back from the doctor and said it was twins, it was like, sorry, Don, you're spending the next 20 years in slavery.
You did her a favor by getting her away from Reinhardt.
That's a nice thing to say. The truth is, we wouldn't have stayed together anyhow.
Do you know a man named Joe Staggers?
Everybody in Mountree knows Joe Staggers. Most wish they didn't. It's all a mistake, but Staggers thinks he has a grudge against me. This grudge, the guy named Minor Keys involved in that?
So I hear.
If you're going to be around more than a couple days, you might see can you borrow a weapon from someone. Staggers is a mean son of a bitch.
At a table in a windowed alcove next to the kitchen door, Kavi was polishing off his spaghetti. Lori asked, how'd it go?
He's a nice guy.
Posey sprang from her chair.
Bedtime.
She wiped the red smears from Kavi's face. All right, upstairs. Maybe we can get Ned to say goodnight to you once you're in bed. Kavi looked at me with a blast of anticipatory joy. I would have bet anything that Stuart never tucked him in at night. He kissed his mother and flew out of the kitchen, Posey behind him. Lori stood up.
What happened to your glass?
I left it in the other room. When I returned, I sat down next to her and put From Beyond on the table. Lori flipped through random pages. She grinned and read aloud.
Mr. Waterstone, creaked the old librarian from the musty darkness of his sinister lair. The means by which you acquire that ancient text are of no interest to me.
Lori looked up at me. In books, I don't think people should creak or anything else like that. They should just say things. Edward Reinhardt may not be the author for you, I surmised. She closed the book.
Tell me about Donald Messmer.
I condensed Messmer's tale without mentioning what he had said about Joe Staggers. Posey Fairbrother swung around the entrance to the kitchen. Your admirer awaits you. When I tucked Cobby in, I went downstairs where Lori Hatch and I were borne along on a tide of conversation. Did you want to hear the end of that Reinhardt story? The perfect farewell to Mr. Reinhardt, Lori said. This is the story you were reading when I showed up? I was almost done. The whole first half sounds almost autobiographical. I condensed Godfrey Demmerman's early life into a couple of sentences and briefly described his adventures in the village of Markham, the obsession with his ancestral house, his simultaneous flight from and pursuit of the other, leading to the night when he was drawn to the library on the top floor. Carry on, she implored. I continued reading. Godfrey found it within himself to advance forward and cast his eye over the musty vacancy. Who are you, unholy figure? He brought forth. Slowly, with dragging step, an indistinct figure emerged from the shadows. Demmerman found himself unable to breathe. The other's features were hideously, inescapably Demmerman's own. Had all his efforts been designed but to bring him face to face with this monstrous version of himself? Godfrey Demmerman turned and ran for his life. He thought he heard laughter behind him, but the laughter was only an echo of his shame. He thought dragging footsteps pursued him down the stairs, but heard only the pounding of his heart. From half-open doors and shrouded corners, the lithe, misshapen creatures seemed to peer out, awaiting his final surrender. He would not yield in defeat. He had been born to a great purpose. Demmerman advanced upon the door to the gallery, thrust it open, and found in his pocket the book of matches. The bright flame trembled as he knelt before the first of the long curtains. A small, quivering flame sprang to life and inched upward. Soon rows of flame from the upright columns spread across the floorboards and the ceiling. He backed into the smoky hall and let himself out into the night. The ground floor window shattered and released plumes so dark as to obscure the blaze within. Above the roar of the conflagration, Demmerman fancied that he heard the high-pitched screams of the creatures trapped at the top of the house, and the thought of their panic caused a savage rejoicing in his breast. No sooner had he cast his eyes upward to glimpse the fifth-floor windows than the first signs of firelight shone behind them, then deepened from yellow to red. A silhouette moved into the frame of the window and looked out with supernal calm. The window frame ignited around the dark shape, illuminated the ruined visage so like and unlike his own. The other again issued his implacable claim. His hair burst into flame. Behind him the fire darkened from red to the deep blue once witnessed at the heart of an ancient forest. In the other's demand, it came to him with the weight of a majestic paradox, by an unforeseen fate to which Demmerman's suddenly exalted spirit gave its full assent. He sprinted and plunged into the burning building. An instant later, what remained of the interior gave way. And with a yielding sigh of capitulation, the great structure folded in upon itself and shuddered downward upon Godfrey Demmerman's ecstatic release. Lori took a sip of wine. He had to rid the world of himself, not to mention his family house and the little crawly things. Poor old Godfrey, I said. We could manage a happier ending than that, Ned. Are you interested? Aha! What we have here is a decided show of interest. What did Edward Reinhardt know about ecstatic release? Afterward, in her bed, the sight of her beautiful, tawny face so close to mine made me feel blessed. Some of the women I had known may have been more passionate than Lori, but none were more gracefully attuned to the capacity of each individual moment to spread its wings and glide into the next. A few hours later, I awakened with the old sense of having to get on my way before trouble found me. While I was groping for my socks, I bumped into a lamp. Fuzzily, she asked what I was doing. I told her I was taking a taxi back to the boarding house. She turned on a low bedside lamp and sat up, rubbing her face. I'd drive you, but I'm so tired I think I'd go off the road. Call me tomorrow. She switched off the light as soon as I finished dressing. In my room, I carried the package from the safety deposit box to my table and stripped off layers of brown paper until I uncovered a large, old-fashioned scrapbook. Taped to its front cover was a note card. For Ned. I flipped through the pages of my last secret gift from my mother, growing more and more baffled. Half of its thick pages were news clippings about crimes, unsolved violent deaths, none of which seemed to have any connection to Star or me. Disturbed, I began going through the scrapbook more methodically. The name I had heard from both Hugh Coventry and Suki Teeter jumped out at me from the first few articles. The headline above the first clipping read, "Midwife Accused of Baby Snatching Admits Charges." Hazel Jansky, a local midwife, had come under suspicion when one administrator at St. Anne's Community Hospital noted that over the previous decade, she had been present at 9 stillbirths. Jansky admitted participation in 4 transactions involving the sale of newborn infants to couples unable or unwilling to go through the normal adoption process. The story was dated March 3, 1965. 4 months before my 7th birthday, my mother had opened the morning paper and discovered what she considered proof that she had delivered not a single child, but twins. Jansky claimed to have acted in the baby's interests by rescuing them from unfit mothers. Because a judge and jury found that she had acted in the interests of the stolen children, she spent only 18 months in jail. The next clipping, from the Milwaukee Journal and headed "Double Murder in Suburbia," introduced the unsolved homicides. Milwaukee County pathologists had discovered that Mr. and Mrs. William McClure, previously thought to be victims of the fire that had destroyed their house on Salisbury Road in the suburb of Elm Grove, had died as a result of multiple stab wounds. Their 3-year-old daughter, Lisa McClure, had not, as originally supposed, perished from asphyxiation, but from traumatic injury to the neck. Missing from the scene was 8-year-old Robert McClure, Mr. McClure's nephew. Police held out hope that he had escaped before his presence was noted. The next clipping was headed "Police Station Enigma" from Ottumwa, Iowa, and described another sort of mystery. A police officer named Boyd Burns had noticed a boy of 11 or 12 loitering on the local fairgrounds and suspected him of being a runaway. When asked to turn out his pockets, the boy proved to be carrying more than $400. Suspicious, Burns fingerprinted him, only to discover that the tips of his fingers were devoid of prints. Questioned, the boy replied that he had no need of fingerprints. "It was like he was making fun of me," Burns said. "I asked if he wanted anything to eat, and he said he wouldn't mind a hamburger. So I walked a Burger Whopper a block away. Before I went in, I heard this big whooshing sound. I turned around and saw the whole station go dark for a couple of seconds." Burns ran back. The kid was gone. Asked for his opinion about what had happened, Burns said he believed the boy had been an alien being. "Like from another galaxy. One thing about Earth people, they do have fingerprints. All I can say is, I'm glad the kid isn't in Ottumwa anymore." I turned off the light and fell into bed without bothering to take off my clothes. Dream ropes and dream weights held me to the bed. Held captive in the mind of Mr. X, I saw a door mist into haze. I saw a knife blade, a dark-complected man rise frowning from a chair. When he opened the door, Mr. X flowed in, glided behind him, and slashed his throat. Horrified, I burst my ropes, threw off the weights, and woke up standing beside the bed with my hands flattened over my eyes. I was ready to understand. Nearly all the entries were dated within a day or two of June 25th. I had visited the murdered couples with Mr. X. I had seen them murdered. Star had collected these stories because she feared that Robert was behind them, that Reinhardt was. The newspapers had told her that her second son was loose in the world, wandering from one tragedy to another like a furious ghost. Robert had sent Ashley Ashton to the Motel Comfort because he had known I would be there. The next day, he had rescued me from life in prison by going to bed with her. Robert. Edward Reinhardt. It was too much. I could not work it out. I decided to go out and walk the streets until weariness forced me back to bed. I did not want to be Robert's toy. I hated the idea that he had been maneuvering me, directing me, shaping my life. Once a year, Mr. X had gone in search of Robert, my shadow. Star and Robert had met at least twice, in front of Beagleman's department store and outside Aunt Nettie's house. Surely there had been other meetings. Maybe she had somehow kept Mr. X at bay. Our birthday arrived on the day after her funeral, and Robert could not face the annual challenge alone. He had saved my life because he needed me. I didn't need him. Robert could go to hell. It was fine with me if Mr. X erased him. Brimming with rage, I took another step forward, and a tide of emotion brought me to my knees. Every cell in my body called out for reunion with its other split-off self. I felt like an amputated half, bleeding for the want of what would make it whole. If Robert needed me to defeat Mr. X, I would help him or not, depending on how I felt at the time. When I reached Merchants Park, I noticed the flashing lights of the squad cars and ambulance in front of the Cobden building. A little man with a halo of curls fanning out beneath his cap waved a brown bag at me from a bench. I sat down next to him. "Hello, Piney. What's going on?"
"It looks like somebody broke into the Cobden building. According to one of the cops, whoever got in trashed the place, screwed up the computers, left up the guard, Earl Sawyer. That's why the ambulance."
Piney uttered a phlegmy chuckle.
"Here's the boss."
A thick-set man in a blue button-down shirt burst through the door and took charge. "Stuart Hatch?"
"Of the Hatchtown Hatches."
Piney and I moved onto the sidewalk. The paramedics were shifting the unconscious guard onto a gurney. Stuart Hatch gave a dismissive glance at the onlookers.
"Go home. The show's over."
His eyes stopped when they came to me. They widened with a kind of shock of recognition. He had us followed, I thought. He saw pictures of Lori and me. Hatch's thick, already suntanned legs propelled him before Lieutenant Raleigh and Captain Mullen. Raleigh found me with his dead face and dead eyes. He moved up onto my side of the street, planted himself in front of me.
"The bus station is on Grace Street, 3 blocks down from Town Square. That's one choice. But stick around and have us drop in tomorrow morning."
"Did Hatch tell you to say that, Lieutenant?"
Raleigh hit me in the stomach, hard.
I spun onto the grass. Raleigh skipped up and kicked me under my ribs. The cops on the other side of the street had turned their backs. Then Raleigh took a step back and walked away. At 10 a.m. on Sunday morning, there was a rap on my door. Helen Jeanette's voice came through.
"Mr. Dunstan, if you don't open up, I'll do it myself."
Clustered behind my landlady were Captain Mullen, Lieutenant Raleigh, Officer Truehaft, and Stuart Hatch. "I want this man arrested, Mullen." Stuart Hatch pointed at me. "This man is in league with my wife. How much are they giving you?" Mullen turned to me.
"Do you have any interest in Mr. Hatch's legal affairs?"
"None at all."
"Your relationships with Assistant D.A. Ashton and Mrs. Hatch are purely social and grew out of accidental encounters?"
"That's right."
"Mr. Dunstan, are you willing to accompany us to St. Anne's? Mr. Sawyer, the security guard who was injured during the break-in, is being held in the ICU. If you come with us now, Mr. Sawyer will either identify you or put you in the clear."
At St. Anne's, the old man in the bed glared at our invasion through glittering eyes, surrounded by an interlocking network of bruises. Hatch tried to pat his hand. Sawyer pulled his hand away.
"I got no health insurance and no pension plan."
Hatch grinned at the two cops.
"Earl, this is not the time to discuss business. We'd like you to look at the man in the blue shirt on the other side of the bed and tell us if you recognize him." "You use the word business. I put in 15 years with you, and some guy comes along and pounds the bejesus out of me. You know what would be right? A one-time settlement of $25,000.
Hatch stared up at the dim ceiling of the ICU.
"Well, Earl, if you think a settlement like that would suit you, you got it."
Sawyer nodded at him.
"I'm glad we're in agreement, Mr. Hatch."
Hatch raised his arms in defeat.
"Earl, I could use you on my team. Tell us if he resembles the man who assaulted you in the Cobden building."
Earl Sawyer squinted at me.
"Come closer. Didn't I talk to you a couple of days ago? When I was letting myself in?"
"Friday evening."
"You heard Mr. Hatch agree to my deal, didn't you?" I did. You got the wrong guy, Pearl said. I hardly saw the guy, but this isn't him.
While Hatch signed away $25,000, the four of us drifted out. When Hatch thrust aside the curtain and stamped out, his face was tight with anger. He took a deep breath.
I didn't know the old bastard had it in him.
His face split into a grin and he chuckled. The chuckle was built into outright laughter.
Old Earl flat bushwhacked me.
I confess this performance disarmed me. At that moment, I could not help liking Stuart Hatch.
All right, Stuart said. Live and learn. I can take Mr. Dunstan home. You guys have things to do, and it's on my way.
When we had all spun through the revolving door, Mullen questioned me with a look, and I said,
Sure, why not?
Stuart Hatch opened the passenger door of his Mercedes and beckoned me in with a flourish. We drove out of the hospital grounds like a couple of old friends. Hatch was smiling and his eyes filled with a comfortable, humorous light.
There's something I'd like to show you. We can get there in about 20 minutes. Can you spare the time?
As long as you're not going to march me into a field and show me a gun.
5 green lights and a nearly empty road had appeared before us. Now that we're together like this, Stuart, you realize I have nothing to do with what happened at your building.
I'm relieved, as a matter of fact. But that still leaves me with the computer damage.
Aren't you an expert in that area?
I wouldn't go that far.
Would you like to make $10,000 a week?
It looks like about half the files are missing from our hard disks, and I need to recover them.
Sounds great, but I'd rather not be on the Hatch payroll.
Too bad. It was a long shot, but too bad.
He grinned.
And what about my wife?
Forget it, Stuart. Your marriage has nothing to do with me.
Between us, she isn't so great in bed, is she? When it comes to performance, this car is a lot more satisfying. My wife is too selfish to be a good lay.
Stuart, you're embarrassing yourself.
She's a soulless bitch.
If she's that terrible, divorce her.
He laughed at me.
Jesus, I don't care about her personality. I just want her to do what I say.
Did my dear wife tell you anything about the trust? She gave you a son and heir, and your son is the reason you can't divorce Lori. His smile shrank. What kind of spin did she put on it?
I described what I could remember.
Not that. At 35, Tabby will come into a great deal of money. Do you know why my father wrote in the condition about criminal charges?
Laurie said something about his brother.
Oh, it had nothing to do with that. I turned 18 in 1968. My senior year at Edgerton Academy, one night after dinner, I forgot to lock my door. I'm sitting on the floor with Jumping Jack Flash blasting through my speakers and smoking dope. And wham! In comes my father. Cobden goes nuts. I had to cut my hair, and he let me know that if I ever got into trouble with the law, I wouldn't get a penny from the trust.
Are you worried about that case in Kentucky?
It's nothing but dust and hot air. Be gone in a week. But yesterday afternoon, my wife called the attorney for the trust, Parker Gillespie. She asked if I'm convicted of these crimes. I, of course, did not commit. Am I really disinherited? Unfortunately, Gillespie said, that would be the case. She wants the money. Cobby wouldn't inherit until 35. Lori would appoint herself administrator and grab whatever she wanted.
Thanks for the explanation. Take me back to town.
I want you to see something, remember?
You'll be astonished.
History is going to rise up and speak.
60 years ago, the overgrown field had been a meadow. The stark remains at the edge of the wood, a tall stone house with dormers and a portico.
Ned, has anyone ever told you about the old Dunstan place?
After his brother was killed, Sylvan imported the stones from England and had it rebuilt, I said.
Hatch raised his eyebrows.
England?
It was Providence, Rhode Island. That's why this street is named New Providence Road.
I know more about your family than you do.
A man named Omar Dunstan originally built the place. He turned up in Providence in the 1750s with a bunch of West Indian servants and a lot of money. Dunstan called himself an importer. What do you think he was importing? Human beings. He sold them in the southern colonies. Dunstan wasn't married, but he produced 3 or 4 children who almost never left the house. The neighbors heard strange noises and saw peculiar lights in the windows. There were rumors about witchcraft and black magic. Finally, a party of citizens raided the house with the intention of driving the family out of town. They were too late. The place was empty. I had to sit down, and I parked myself in the hood of the Mercedes as Stuart continued. The place stood empty for decades. People called it the Shunned House. In the end, they built a fence around it and let it crumble for the next 100 years. During the Civil War, 2 brothers named Dunstan escaped from the stockade, where they were being held for corpse robbing. In 1874, Omar and Sylvan Dunstan turned up in Edgerton and moved into the Brazen Head. Before long, they had enough money to set up in business, Omar as a pawnbroker and Sylvan as a moneylender. 10 years later, they had taken over the bank and were living out in the boonies on Cherry Street. When floods bankrupted people, they foreclosed and Sylvan bought the properties for next to nothing. I always thought it was kind of strange that Omar was the one who got killed, because people here really hated Sylvan. My father thought Sylvan killed Omar. By then, Omar was turning into a respectable citizen. My father said Sylvan didn't give a damn about respectability, and he was tired of sharing Omar's wife. I heard about their arrangement, I said. Sylvan shipped these stones from Rhode Island and brought out a crew of Portuguese workmen he put up out here in shacks. People in town thought he didn't want them to know what his house was like. There were rumors, I said. Stuart nodded. Chains attached to beds in the attic, concealed hideaways. His kids grew up like animals. Howard, your grandfather, stayed on the plantation even though he hated his old man. Supposedly, Sylvan shot himself cleaning a gun, but some said your grandfather did it for him. Anyhow, Howard went the same way as Sylvan and screwed every woman he could get his hands on. Ran the bank into the ground, threw away his money. You know what people used to say about him when I was a kid? That he could be in 2 places at once, I said. Go through doors without opening them. Read your mind and predict the future. Float off the ground and hang in the air. Hatch gave me a surprised, disgruntled look. I was not supposed to know about Howard Dunstan. It's a good thing his daughters moved back to Cherry Street, because one night the house burned up around him. Howard's daughters got the insurance money, and that was that. I barely felt him putting his hand on my shoulder. No matter what my wife says, Stuart Hatch is not a bad guy. He laughed. His teeth were marvels of dentistry. Stuart, you can be completely charming, but you belong in jail. It would be a tragedy if you got custody of your son. He jerked his hands out of his pockets. If you want to lift back to town, call the payphone down the road. I turned my back on him and moved like a sleepwalker into the dense growth covering the field. An engine whirred into life, and gravel flew like buckshot from beneath squealing tires. Darkness and nightmare boomed from the ruined house and the trees behind it. The right half of the house had collapsed into a soft depression. I moved to the rear of the house. It was like looking at a photograph from a bombed city. Blackened walls and empty space. My feet met a flat stone surface. When I bent down and parted the grasses, I saw a gray marble slab carved with the legend, Omar Dunstan, died 1887. Its companion was 3 feet away. Sylvan Dunstan died 1900. How about you, Howard? About 6 feet from Sylvan's marker was Howard Dunstan, our dear father, 1882 to 1935. Better than you deserve. I noticed an area where the grasses bent over the ground. Before the first of the trees, a flat granite slab lay over the gray-brown mulch. I read the eroded, still legible words, "Angels, not of this earth." Altogether, 8 other markers lay hidden in the grass. Some of the names had worn away, and none were the kind of names parents give their children.